In 2004, Google began a project to digitize millions of books in order to make them available free online through its book search. Although the project offers everyone access through the internet, it sparked a debate over the rights to these works and what Google's book project might mean for writers and publishers and libraries. A class action lawsuit was filed by the Authors Guild, the Association of American Publishers, and some individual writers and publishers, and earlier this year they reached a groundbreaking settlement with Google. It's yet to be approved by the court, and not everyone is happy with it. But to explain the Google Book Project, the settlement, and what it means for the future of digital books, we have asked Tim Barton, president of the U.S. arm of Oxford University Press, to join us, Robert Darnton, the Carl H. Forsheimer University Professor and Director of the Harvard University Library, and Adam Smith, Director of Product Management at Google. And I'm very pleased to welcome you all to our show. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having us today. Hello.
Adam, can you explain how the Google project got started?
Absolutely. Google Book Search was actually a dream of the founders of Google prior to even founding Google. They, when they were back at Stanford, were on a digital library committee where they were really thinking about how much more powerful books would be if in aggregate they were all digital and easy to find.
How many books? Go ahead.
Beginning even prior to 24, beginning prior to 19, to 2004, we had a vision to make books as searchable and discoverable as web pages are today. And we really believe that for researchers, academics, students, and just general users of the web, being able to find every word within every book creates a really powerful search experience.
How many books have been digitized so far, and how many do you plan to digitize?
Yeah, so our vision is to really create this database of all the world's books, so all books in all languages. Thus far, we believe we've made really good progress. We've digitized over 10 million books. Of that 10 million, over a million are in the public domain, so there's no more copyright associated with them, and they're freely available on our website for reading and downloading. And the balance are still books that may or may not be in copyright, and over a million of those come from direct partnerships we have with publishers, and today we have over 28,000 publisher partnerships.
What's the process of digitizing books?
So we really set out when we initiated this project to change the economics of book digitization. We really drove a proprietary technology that allowed us to substantially decrease the cost of digitization. And we do so by, you know, the simplest way to think about it is, you know, we take pictures of book pages and we extract the text from it to allow users to search over the full text. And so this, again, the real innovation here was our ability to do this at a cost that was about a tenth, 10% of what the previous commercial cost had been.
I would assume some of these books are quite old. Is there ever a concern about causing damage to the actual books?
Yeah, all of our scanning technology was developed in close coordination with our library partners, and as you can imagine, our library partners, who for hundreds of years have been curating these collections, were very interested in maintaining the quality of the book and the integrity of the book. And so the scanning processes were designed explicitly to minimize the damage to the books. And it exerts no more force on a book than just flipping through the pages would.
Was the issue of copyright addressed at the start?
Absolutely. So one of the challenging aspects of this project from the beginning was that books are in a range of copyright states, some known and some unknown. We really, as a project, felt that the one of the most important aspects was ensuring that all of the world's books would be included in this database from the beginning. Google believed firmly that it was within the existing copyright law for us to take a copy of these books and digitize and index them. The important point to note here is that for books that we didn't have a direct agreement with the publishers, we were not displaying the full page of the book. We would only show equivalent to what a Google search result looks like today, what we were calling a snippet. So this would allow people to discover books, but not necessarily to read them online. So we designed the product, again, with existing copyright laws in mind, at the time when we initially launched it.
Was Google surprised when the lawsuit was filed?
We have very strong relationships, like I said, today currently 28,000 publishers. So we knew how the publishing industry was feeling about this when it was launched. So I wouldn't say we were surprised. We actually, one of the interesting facts about the lawsuits is everyone on the publishing from the publishing side that entered into the litigation with us was also a partner with us and through the direct relationships called the partner program. So we had very open communication channels throughout with the publisher. So I wouldn't say we were surprised.
Robert, can you explain the reasoning behind the lawsuit?
Well, I'm not a partner to the lawsuit, so
that's why I'm asking you because you have an objective overview.
Well, I'll try to be objective. I think that certainly the authors and the publishers felt that they had a proprietary interest in their copyrights and that Google was infringing them. Google's argument was, I believe, a strong argument, namely that by showing only snippets, it was not breaking copyright at all, but actually making the books more accessible to potential readers. And so this could have gone to court, and it could have been a fair use case, as we call it. But that didn't happen. Instead, there were, I think, something like 2.5 years of secret negotiations between the authors and the publishers on the one hand and Google on the other, the result of which was this settlement, which is now about to go to court October 7th. It will appear before a court, and the judge will either authorize it or not authorize it. So that's going to be the critical moment at which we will begin to see the shape not just of Google and its relations with authors and publishers, but really the whole landscape of the digital future. The stakes are very high.
Tim, you're the president of the U.S. arm of Oxford University Press, and you publish the kinds of books that people probably would go to this Google book search for, because many of them are not bestsellers. They're the kinds of books that researchers would use and such. Did you object to the Google plan?
No. Oxford University Press has come out in support of the Google plan. There are things about the settlement itself and implications of the settlement about which we're concerned. But overall, we think that the settlement, in particular by bringing back to life many millions of books, which I think, practically speaking, wouldn't or are very unlikely to be made available ever again, making those books searchable, citable, and a range of conditions around free public access, increased search. I think what was good about the settlement was that it stepped beyond the issues around copyright and the original court case to come up with something that I think is more radical, more interesting, and transformative.
Well, we'll get into that, but I'm wondering about what happens to publishers. Adam mentioned that 1 million of these books are in the public domain, and it's been my sense that publishers love those kinds of books because they can find an old classic, they can publish it and not have to pay anybody, and keep it in print for a long time, know that there's almost a guaranteed sale as long as they can keep a fair number of them in a warehouse.
Well, I think if a book is in a public domain, then the publisher has no more rights over that title than any other individual.
And anybody can't publish it unless it's a translation that's copyrighted?
Anyone can make that work available. The public domain titles that are in the settlement are not really where the issues have been, because publishers have either never had or have lost those rights. The issue that's been contentious has been the in-copyright books, particularly the out-of-print in-copyright books.
My guests are Tim Barton, who's president of the U.S. arm of Oxford University Press, Robert Daunton, president of the Harvard Libraries, and Adam Smith, director of product management at Google. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Robert, how long does a copyright last?
It's a very good question. We have the most complicated copyright laws that you can imagine, and Congress keeps changing them. But to simplify things, I would say until the death of the author plus 70 years. That means in practice that most books will be kept out of the public domain for about a century. And in fact, most 20th century literature is now still in copyright and fenced off from free access by the public.
There are orphan works, so-called orphan works. They are the ones that are covered by copyright, but nobody publishes?
Well, yes. The phrase orphan works seizes everybody's imagination, and it can be somewhat misleading. But again, to simplify, between 1923 and 1964, there was a kind of limbo in which the copyright status of books is not altogether clear. So many books published during that important time period have now passed out of print, but they haven't passed out of copyright. And we don't know frequently who actually owns those copyrights. Sometimes they were published by publishers who went out of business, disappeared. Sometimes they were written by authors who died, but whose heirs don't even know that they possess the copyright, etc. So there is a huge corpus of books that whose actual legal status is unclear. And what the settlement does, because it is a class action suit, the settlement in effect transfers control over the over access to those orphan books, this huge stock of books, to Google Book Search. And in a way, it's changing copyright law by means of litigation.
Because I'm assuming, Tim, that a publisher like Oxford University Press claims to own the copyrights to any number of works that it's not planning to put out in hard copy in the near future.
Yes, if Oxford University Press knows that it has the copyright to the book, but it's out of print, it can choose to invest the money in digitization and other aspects of publishing a book in order to bring that back to life.
And you could do it on your own without going through Google.
And we can do it on our own without going to Google. We can't do that for orphan works, and there are some books published by Oxford University Press where we can't actually assert the rights. We may have lost a file. So to some extent, we may be in a strange position where a book published by Oxford University Press, say in 1950, Oxford University Press can't itself make available, but Google can. The question is it better that someone is making that book available or no one can make that book available?
Now, Adam, was Google aware of the messy situation when it got started in this project?
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
I said, was Google aware of just how messy some of these issues are when it got started on this project?
Yeah, I was in responding to just what was stated there. I mean, the agreement doesn't, you know, as Robert said, transfer control to Google. What it really does is it improves tremendously the access that both the average user as well as folks in universities and elsewhere will have to this vast set of works. And what's important to distinguish here is that there's a significant number of books, let's call it greater than 70% of all the world's books that have ever been published, that are no longer in print and not clearly in the public domain. But not being in print is not equivalent to being an orphan work. Google believes that the actual number of orphan works will be quite a small number once the Books Rights Registry, which is established through this agreement, becomes effective, and the opportunity for the so-called parents of these orphan works is made available for them to come forward and both state their ownership of these works and, to the extent money has been generated, claim money. So there will be real incentive for the rights holders to come forward to claim these works. So we really believe that at the end that this agreement will provide tremendously enhanced access to these works, which today are very difficult to access for the average person.
Now, Robert, have we pretty much covered all aspects of this complex settlement, or are there other things that we should address before we move on?
Well, there are lots of other things. It's a fascinating document. It's not easy to read because it's, in my copy, is about 130 pages of legalese. But it's very, very important because it is going to, as I said, more or less set the rules of the game for our digital future, not completely, but to a very great extent. And like Tim, I think that potentially this Google book search is something of great benefit to the public. It's going to be simply fabulous, a gigantic database composed of millions of volumes, which now will be within reach for the average reader. The question is, under what terms? And that's where the issue is joined, because the settlement does give Google tremendous power over this public asset, really. And it leaves no room for the public itself to be represented. So readers and libraries are not represented on the registry, which is going to be the key intermediate in dealing with Google and setting prices and so on. And I think that because the public's interest is so central to this, that there should be some role for the public, some representation for the public, and some way to defend the public against the danger of monopolistic pricing. Because Google really is a monopoly. Some monopolies are very good and provide terrific services. I'm a great admirer of Google, but I think there is a danger in creating a monopoly of access to information that will be all-powerful and that will control the whole digital world, as far as I can see, in the foreseeable future. So that's what we're worried about.
We'll address that whole issue of monopoly in a few moments, because we have to go to a break. But I just want to point out that the settlement was reached in late October 2008. It still has to be approved by a U.S. District Court judge. And publishers, authors, and rights holders have until this September to decide if they'll accept the terms. If a publisher decides not to accept the settlement, where does that leave them, Tim?
Any rights holder can decide to not be part of this settlement. The benefit to not being part of the settlement is one retains the right to sue Google. That seems a slim benefit. If one can choose to be part of the settlement, yet pull all of one's copyrights out. There are a whole range of possibilities. No one is really being forced to do anything here.
My guests are Tim Barton, president of the U.S. arm of Oxford University Press, Robert Darnton, president of the Harvard Libraries, and Adam Smith, director of product management at Google. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with our discussion of the Google Book Project and the settlement that is still in the courts. My guests are Adam Smith, Director of Product Management at Google, Tim Barton, who is president of the U.S. arm of Oxford University Press, and Robert Darnton, who's president of the Harvard Libraries. Adam, are you there?
I am here.
You wanted to talk about the whole matter of Google being a monopoly, and I cut you off. But that's because I wanted to give you real time to talk about
it. I was going to respectfully disagree with Robert around the point of us being a monopoly with respect to this information, and that really at its heart, a lot of the agreement is meant to...
We're getting a lot of feedback there. Is that still a problem? Hello, Adam?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. You said you were in mid-sentence when you were obliterated by some feedback.
Oh, I apologize for that. I don't know where it cut off. What I was saying is I respectfully was going to disagree with Robert around the comment of Google being a monopoly with respect to this information, and that really at its heart this agreement was meant to engender more competition for access to these works, and the Books Rights Registry has the ability to provide a license for these materials for rights holders that come forward, and that really when that these books still will be available on the bookshelves of all of these libraries and available for users to be able to access and make available to the folks that they're interested in doing it, and the agreement is also non-exclusive. So there are a lot of parts of this that actually will bring a lot more competition to this market.
But Adam, doesn't this give Google an awful lot of power because it's the only company with a project as far-reaching? And the settlement is Google-specific, isn't it?
So yes, Google has invested a lot of money into this effort to really bring this information forward because we believe that this is something that is good for the world. But at the end, the rights registry will have the ability for rights holders to come forward to be able to license this material to those individuals that are interested in creating other models. Additionally, there are lots of existing models in the market today for access to digital books that will continue to thrive, and we believe as the market continues to become more digital, especially for research and other types of activities, that you'll see even additional entrants come to the market with their solutions, such as the Barnes & Noble announcement that happened yesterday.
Tim, you want to get into that?
I think one of the problems here is actually a branding problem in that the settlement has become known as the Google Book Settlement. Google is a party to this agreement, but it's an agreement, a compromise. I think it's a compromise for everyone, and everyone comes out of it better off. But authors and publishers and all rights holders are part of this agreement. I came to this settlement with the same instincts as Bob, I think, which is Google has a very dominant, has a predominant position in search, and when it turns its attention your way, you better look out.
Well, nowadays people don't say I'm going to anything other but Google, even if they're going to use some other search engine.
Absolutely, but I think in going to the settlement, and I shared Bob's concerns about the legalese, it's not a pleasant read. When you do get into the detail of the settlement, it does provide real reassurance. And Bob and all of us can, I think, agreed, and it was good to hear us agreeing on how the tremendously enhanced access is important, but what we need to look at are the terms of the settlement. And if you take an area like pricing, there are so many protections, and I think authors and publishers have done a good job in putting protections into the agreement, and Google has agreed to those protections. So, for example, pricing, there are principles around what pricing of the products will be. One of those principles is broad access by the public. Another principle is market rates. And I think in general, one commentator has made the interesting point that you don't tend to find monopoly profits being made in a situation where a significant proportion of every book is, generally speaking, 20%, is freely available. There's free access to any reader visiting a public library at one terminal, all public libraries and universities. So that means there are 20,000 terminals in the United States at any one point providing free access. The original books are still available. And if you look at the two products that are announced in the settlement, in one case, the rights holders set the prices if they want to. And in the other case, Google can propose them. The Books Rights Registry, which is an independent organization, has to agree to those. And it goes to independent arbitration if it doesn't.
So, Robert, does that sound like a monopoly to you?
I think that the description of the settlement simply doesn't hold up because the settlement, in fact, creates an all-powerful monopoly, and it does so in three ways. First of all, de facto, Google has no competition for this kind of mass digitizing. Digitizing is going on all over the place, but Google has this marvelous vision of digitizing all the books and all the languages of the world, and only Google so far has been able to do that.
Well, is that their fault if other people haven't come up with...
No, it's not their fault. I applaud them. I think it's fabulous, their engineering ability and their, you know, secret algorithms. All of this is wonderful and is creating a fabulous product. Microsoft tried to do it and dropped out. But I'm simply asserting that Google is the only player in this particular mass digitization game. Now, the settlement is a class action settlement, and that means no competitor can even enter into the game unless that competitor strikes a deal with every rights holder of every copyright, which is impossible. So there is a legal exclusion of the competition. And then thirdly, there is a so-called most favored nation clause in the settlement, which by according to which the book rights registry cannot accept more favorable terms from a competitor than the terms that it's already given to Google. So there are,
Well, that cuts down on competition, doesn't it?
It certainly does. I think that it will be, if this settlement is upheld by the court, I think that no one can compete with Google on this ground.
Tim?
I mean, the most favored nation clause is a clause that I don't like. It is, however, a clause that only comes into effect in certain very specific circumstances, which follow on from should there be orphan works legislation over and above the Google settlement. So it is quite a technical clause. I don't like it. I don't think it's in the spirit of the overall agreement. And my suggestion to Google, if I can be so bold, would be that they should strike that out. I think on the question of no competitor can enter the game, again, I think we need to be quite careful about the terms here. Competitors will be able to license from the Books Rights Registry any work that is in copyright. It will only be the orphan works, and there is a genuine question about how many of those there will be, but it will only be the orphan works that can't be licensed.
But one of the things Robert pointed out in an article he wrote for the New York Review of Books is that there are often many different versions of a text, and Google has to choose, or somebody has to choose, which one is the or authoritative one, the authentic one.
Yes, if I may respond to that. First of all, often Google just takes what comes off the shelf and doesn't select the best text, which can be a great disadvantage for serious readers and teachers. But as to the business of a competitor having access to the digitized database, I think there, Tim, that you've got it wrong, because you must remember that Google owns this database, and so the registry cannot make that database available without Google's consent. Well, and Google's not about to do that, to hand it over to some competitor.
I think one needs to draw a distinction between the scans that Google has made, which Google owns, and the Books Rights Registry cannot license those scans. However, the Books Rights Registry is entirely independently able to license any copyright to a commercial competitor under the agreement. So, I mean, I went to the agreement. I thought one of the interesting things would be if Google actually had found a way to make those scans more broadly available. I would have welcomed that. But that doesn't limit the Book Rights Registry's ability to license copyright material to other competitors.
My guests are but I want to get to you, Adam, in just a second. Tim Barton is president of the U.S. arm of Oxford University Press. Robert Darnton is president of the Harvard Libraries. And Adam Smith is director of product management at Google. Adam?
Yeah, and I was going to say, importantly here, the Books Rights Registry is really run and controlled by the publishers and authors. And as Tim pointed out, they will have the ability to license as kind of a one-stop shop the rights to another competitor to utilize these works for the rights holders that have come forward. So it, in many ways, it will actually make it much easier for someone to enter this market and begin to offer similar services to what Google is providing.
Now, a listener, Adam, asks, doesn't this involve the shutting down of the not-for-profit Internet Archive scanning of books, which is the second largest book scanning project after Google's?
Not at all. In fact, many of our partners on the library space are working with both us and the Internet Archive. The Internet Archive continues to do great work in terms of digitizing works and making them available similar to what Google is doing across, you know, primarily public domain works. This in no way would shut down the work that they're doing.
No, I agree. The problem really has to do with books that are covered by copyright, and especially out-of-print books covered by copyright. Now, it's true that the registry can license to a competitor the ability to make such books available if the competitor can scan them. But this settlement locks these books up under the control of Google. I mean, here at Harvard, we have 16 million books. I would love to make them accessible to Google and to the rest of the world, but under terms that would benefit the public. But this way, you see, only Google has digitized its database of books, and no one else can have access to those books unless they get permission from the copyright owners, which is going to be impossible according to the settlement. So I don't agree that the settlement opens up competition. I think it closes it down.
So should I assume Harvard will not accept the settlement?
No, you shouldn't. I want to accept it. In fact, I love Google, and I want to be a cheerleader for Google. The only reason...
And I'm sure all the students at Harvard who have to go out there to those used bookstores would be thrilled to have access to these books now.
That's right. And not just Harvard. There is what I call the Oberlin argument. That is to say, there are many wonderful small colleges scattered over this country and the rest of the world that don't have really important research libraries. So the Google Book Search has the potential of making a fabulous number of books, millions of books available to places like Oberlin, and this I see as a tremendous gain. So please don't get me wrong. I'm not anti-Google, but I feel that this is such an important turning point in the whole development of the new digital world that we've got to get it right. And I think the settlement as it now stands does not get it right, because, above all, it creates this ironclad monopoly that will exclude competition.
Well, we have just a few moments left, and Adam, I really want to get into one other issue. If I want to get a book through the Google library, what would the process be, and how would I pay, or would I have to pay?
Yeah, so this is one of the really cool elements of the settlement, if it is approved, is, you know, today you wouldn't be able to get access to these books online and digitally. And even if the litigation had gone through and Google had won or the plaintiffs had won, we would not have been able to deliver such services. But by coming to this agreement, if it's approved, the way it would work is you would do a search on Google, you would find a book that you are interested in, and you would have the ability right there to purchase access to that book in its entirety and effectively be able to unlock it online and read it online or do research with it online.
And Tim, would Oxford University Press get the same amount of money for that sale that it gets when it publishes its own books?
I mean, the terms and the split of revenues between authors and publishers is all enshrined in the settlement. That's one of the things that, on the whole, publishers, I think, and authors like about it. It does depend on things like is it in print? Is it out of print? When was it published? Was it pre-1987? Was it post-1987? But in general, I think it's fair to say that the rates that are in the agreement would be considered by most parties to be considered to be reasonable and fair.
Is there some kind of an arrangement with Amazon so that this can also be accessed by a Kindle? And many people are concerned that Amazon controls the Kindle market.
So as it is today, the agreement does not allow for downloading of books. It's mm-hmm. just for online viewing of books.
So I'd have to read it on my computer.
Yeah, or your mobile phone or other places that are internet access enabled.
Mm-hmm. So I could not have a hard copy that I would be able to go back to every so often.
The agreement also envisions a future model, which would include print on demand, that would allow us at a future date to strike a deal with the registry to allow for people to have printed copies of the books. But the current agreement that is under consideration does not have that model included.
And are the publishers concerned about the possibility that people will be able to download and print books?
I mean, I very much hope that they will be able to download, and there will be, whether it's print on demand or ebook downloads. One of the interesting aspects of the settlement is, where is it going to go? There are so many intellectual and commercial issues that this raises. At 323 odd pages, the settlement was a pretty good first stab, but there are details missing, and it'll be interesting to see how it develops.
Just one thing, Adam, aren't a lot of these books already available through Gutenberg.org?
Yeah, Gutenberg, which has been around for, you know, I think over a decade at this point, has did a lot of great work initially in terms of digitizing many of the highest profile public domain works. And so, yeah, a lot of those books are still available there
for free.
I don't know what number they're up to, but as I said, we're well over a million public domain books strong at this point that are all available on our website for download at books.google.com.
Did you have to make a deal with Gutenberg? Well, you don't make a deal as a publisher because they're all public domain books.
Yeah, the way our deals were is they were all non-exclusive deals with our library partners. Where we are able to digitize a copy of the book. We provide them a copy back for their uses, and then we make the copy available on our website.
Thank you so much. We've run out of time, unfortunately, but this is a fascinating topic. We've been talking about the Google Book Project and Settlement with Adam Smith, Director of Product Management at Google, with Robert Darnton, who is Director of the Harvard Libraries, and with Tim Barton, President of the U.S. Arm of Oxford University Press. Thank you all so much.
Thank you very much.
On tomorrow's show, we'll investigate the high cost of retail discounting. Then historian and biographer Carolyn Moorhead on the combined diaries of Marie Antoinette and Madame de la Tour du Pin. Also, the head writer for The Onion's entertainment section on his new book, The Big Rewind, about how pop culture saved his life. Plus, our latest underreported and backstory segments. Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neeshick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Angela Sheldon, Miranda Schaefer, Natalie Pano, and Nicol Silversack. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.